This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The CIA and the National Security Agency are famous for their secrecy, so it may surprise you to hear that they've outsourced many of their core tasks to private contractors. According to the new book, Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing, tasks that are now outsourced include running spy networks out of embassies, intelligence analysis, covert operations, and the interrogation of enemy prisoners. My guest, Tim Shurrock, is the author of Spies for Hire. It's about what he describes as the intelligence industrial complex, the agencies it serves, and the revolving door between the government intelligence community and its contractors. Shurrock is a journalist who's written about the intersection of business and national security for more than 25 years and has been published in The Nation, Mother Jones, and Salon. Tim Shurrock, welcome to Fresh Air. You say that the private companies are now involved in the analysis of intelligence, and you say in your book that there are private contractors involved in putting together the president's daily briefing and the threat matrix, which are both pretty secretive documents, aren't they?
They're very top-secret documents, highly classified. But yes, any company that's involved in interpreting signals that the National Security Agency picks up, or any contractor that's involved with the CIA in analyzing the information it gets from its agents and sources around the world, will be writing reports that are passed up the chain of command to, you know, high levels of the U.S. government, high levels of the intelligence community. I quote someone in the book saying, you know, the president's daily brief should look like a NASCAR race with corporate logos over it. I think that's a pretty accurate description.
What are some of the concerns that critics of this level of outsourcing have of it?
Well, I think the biggest concern, and one that's being voiced now in Congress and has been for over the last year and a half or so, is the involvement of contractors in very sensitive operations, such as the interrogation of enemy prisoners. I actually got into my own reporting on this after the Abu Ghraib scandal was unearthed, and started reading about the fact that there was some private companies that were involved in the not only the interrogation but some of the abuse that occurred in Abu Ghraib. And so this is one area that there's a lot of concern about having this being done for a profit by private companies. But I think and the whole area of analysis, which we just talked about in terms of things like the president's daily brief or these terrorism briefings that occur every day from the National Counterterrorism Center, the fact that we have private companies involved in this raises a lot of questions, because some of these companies, as I mentioned before, are actually advising these agencies on their future budgets or where to go in terms of technology, that kind of thing. And they're writing reports for the agencies that talk about how to spend money, how to allocate their resources. Yet they have a stake in what's going on. And I think there's a lot of questions being raised by critics about the whole objectivity of these contractors, and can they really do a fair job of assessing the intelligence needs of the country when they themselves will profit from the policies that they help implement?
So critics fear that the profit motive will interfere with intelligence and the analysis of intelligence and the analysis of what kind of intelligence programs are needed.
Well, first of all, a lot of these contractors are there in different agencies, say the CIA. They're there for maybe, under a 1 or 2 or 3 year contract. So they're very different than these sort of, like a lifetime employee of the Central Intelligence Agency. They're there temporarily to do a certain job, a certain task that the intelligence agency needs done and doesn't have the personnel inside to do it. Is a contractor, say who was assigned to a CIA station in Lebanon or Iraq or someplace in the Middle East, is that contractor going to go out, risk his life, risk his career, risk his earnings to infiltrate an organization that the CIA wants to infiltrate? Say, for example, Hezbollah. Former agents that I've talked to don't think so. Don't think that a contractor is going to take that kind of risk. If you're a lifetime you know, CIA agent, you want to move ahead in the agency. You want to prove to your superiors that you're really an excellent asset for them, and you want a future in the intelligence community. I think you'll take greater risks than a private sector contractor would.
Now, does Congress have the same amount of oversight over private contractors as it does over the CIA or the NSA?
Well, they should. The problem is that the great majority of intelligence contracts are classified. They're secret. And so they're known only to the agencies themselves, high-level people in the agencies, as well as high-level people in the companies who have security clearances. And until now, Congress has had very little information about the degree of outsourcing, you know, what companies do for the different agencies, the breakdown, what are the largest contractors, what are the largest contracts. Over the last couple of years, there's been numerous attempts to pass legislation that would force the intelligence community to divulge more information to Congress about contracting. This legislation has never passed for various reasons, and I think that Congress just doesn't know how much outsourcing is going on. And, you know, as I report, something like 70%, that's 70, of the intelligence budget goes to private contracts.
Another aspect of the outsourcing of intelligence is there aren't standards yet on what can be outsourced and what is too sensitive to be outsourced.
Well, what's really stunning is that, you know, after all this time, you know, we've had 7 years of the Bush administration of big increases in the intelligence budget and therefore big increases in contracting. And it goes back to the late years of the Clinton administration. So maybe 10 years of a big expansion of outsourcing. Through all that time, the government has never stopped and said, okay, which of these functions should we outsource? What is inherently governmental? What should stay within the government? They've never done that study. They've never made that kind of oversight in terms of, you know, what is okay to contract and what is not. And that's something that I think we, the American people, need to start doing through our lawmakers is setting some rules. I think there is seems to be general consensus that interrogation is not something that should be outsourced. But what about the whole, you know, high-level intelligence analysis? Do we want to have corporations, you know, writing the president's daily brief?
Do private contractors get the same type of security clearance as people working for the NSA or the CIA would?
Yes, they do. And in fact, that's one of the ways you get work is, you know, you work for an agency like the NSA, you get very high up there and you have your security clearance, you retire, you leave the government, you keep your security clearance, and then you go to work for a contractor. And so, you know, with these intelligence contracts being classified, only certain people within the companies can see them. You have to have a security clearance to even talk about the contracts, to even bid on them. So it's, you know, it's very important to keep that security clearance. And they do have basically the same clearance system that people in the government do, yes.
But probably people with the private companies get paid more than the people in government.
Oh, yes, they do. In some cases, they get paid double, some, as much as triple. And so you have this phenomenon where you have people leaving agencies going to a private company like, say, Lockheed Martin or Khaki International, and they come back and they work for the same agency as a contractor, and only they're making, you know, double the pay. And the company is also getting part of that payment as well. So, you know, in terms of like, is it worth our money? Is it a good investment for the government? I think there's a real serious questions about that.
I guess that's one of the things that I'm really confused about. If you're paying higher salaries for the people who are doing intelligence work but working for private contractors, how is outsourcing saving money? Because that's always been one of the goals of the outsourcing of military or intelligence work is to, you know, downsize government and save money.
Well, that's a really excellent question, and I frankly don't have the answer to it because I think it lies somewhere in the government. Because if you are paying someone double or triple, you know, what's the point? Why not hire, you know, someone to do that for the government for one third of what the private contractor is making? For the agencies, though, I think there's also issues like, okay, say you're at the CIA and you have a lifetime employee, and that lifetime employee has a serious drinking problem or something else like that. It's very hard to get rid of them because they're government employees. If you have a contractor who has a drinking problem, you know, they're out the door the next day. So in some ways, it's easier to deal with contractors from that perspective. But in terms of saving the government money, I don't think it does. And I think we need a change where the agencies really begin, you know, hiring internally and building up the government cadre of intelligence officers.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Shorrock, and he's the author of the new book, Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. And it's about how a lot of the United States intelligence functions have been outsourced to private contractors. One of the things you write about in your book is the revolving door between government intelligence agencies and private contractors doing intelligence work. One example is the Director of National Intelligence, Michael McConnell. You say this is the first time that that job has been held by a former contractor. He formerly chaired Booz Allen Hamilton, which is an intelligence contractor. But before going into the private contracting world, he directed the National Security Agency during the Clinton administration. So in his case, why is the revolving door for him between government intelligence work and private contracting work a concern of yours?
When he was at Booz Allen Hamilton, he ran their military intelligence programs, which were extensive, so he had much contact with the NSA and all the other major collection agencies, the agencies that collect imagery and the agencies that are responsible for military satellites. And he was a consultant to all those agencies as well as to the military high command and the various combat commands. But, okay, so he came from, you know, he was the NSA director in the early years of the Clinton administration, and then he went over to the private sector into Booz Allen, where he had involvement with all kinds of programs and then some very sensitive programs that were being run by the Bush administration after 9/11. And then he goes back and now he's running the whole intelligence community. And so I think the problem is he's so close to all these companies. So from the perspective of, like, you know, efficiency, that's great. But from the perspective of someone really being in charge of the whole U.S. intelligence policy, I think he's too close to the private sectors and the companies. I don't think someone like that can make objective judgments about what should be outsourced and what should not be outsourced. And I think that his relationships over the years to all these companies and individuals within the industry is highly questionable in terms of how we want our intelligence system to be run.
Let's look a little bit at the history of how we've reached this level of intelligence outsourcing. You say that this privatization was set in motion during the Reagan and Clinton administrations. What did Reagan do?
Well, actually, what Reagan did was sort of start this whole process of privatization and outsourcing of government services. And actually, you know, while he was kind of a champion of doing this, people may remember, you know, how he established a commission to go through government and see what functions could be done by private companies as opposed to the government. Reagan actually didn't get very far with it, even though he was a very big proponent of privatization. But under Clinton and Vice President Al Gore, their whole take was, let's make government more efficient. And there was this reinventing government program that Gore actually ran as vice president, which methodically went through all the different government agencies and made them more efficient by operating as a business or outsourcing or even privatizing, selling entire agencies, sub-agencies to private companies. And much more privatization in general was done under Clinton than under Reagan. And that had to do with all kinds of functions of government, you know, from defense to, you know, public safety to the internet. This also combined with budgets being cut and resources being cut for the intelligence agencies as part of the end of the Cold War, as part of the so-called peace dividend. And towards the latter part of the Clinton administration, where you had this ongoing policy of outsourcing and privatization, then when there was an uptick in the need for intelligence officers in the wars in Bosnia and elsewhere, there's issues came up in the second half of his administration where there was a big push for intelligence, greater intelligence spending. And by that time, a lot of people had left. The agencies had gone into the private sector. And so there was almost nowhere else to turn except the private sector. So through a combination of circumstances, it really expanded greatly under Clinton.
Did reliance on private contractors for intelligence increase a lot after September 11th?
Oh, yes. It was just, as the intelligence budgets grew drastically, the increases were phenomenal in terms of spending. And also, the government created new agencies, say the Counterterrorism Center, the National Counterterrorism Center, where I kind of start the book in the very first chapter just saying what it does and then how much of its functions are contracted out. They created new institutions out of whole cloth. And so there was all these institutions needed to be filled with intelligence analysts and officers. And like I said, there was, by that point, so many people had left the agencies and had gone into the private sector that sort of the institutional knowledge of the intelligence community was in the private sector. And so that's where they turned.
You also say that Donald Rumsfeld's vision of net-centric warfare led to a lot of subcontracting of intelligence work. What's the vision, and how did it lead to more subcontracting of intelligence?
Well, there was actually two things that went on. One was, Rumsfeld and his people really pushed this idea of network-centric warfare, which is basically, highly computerized warfare, military operations where intelligence comes in and people, there's a network of a computer network, basically, that distributes the intelligence to commanders and also just warfighters, soldiers on the ground. And the whole idea is to get as much intelligence as possible to the people actually doing the fighting and do it all electronically. And so, when that became it was a big push by Rumsfeld in the early days that he was Secretary of Defense, who does this work? Who does the integration? Who sends the intelligence reports electronically to other military commands, to other agencies? That's the contractors. That's a huge business of integrating all this military intelligence into this kind of network. And so that's become a very big business, particularly for the large, what are called systems integrators, these big defense contractors that tie together various military agencies and intelligence agencies through their computerized information networks. And then just if you look at read the military budgets, if you read the budgets at supplementals in particular to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, you can find all kinds of items that are clearly designed for contractors.
Do you think it's possible that in the era of information, where there's so much information and so many specialized networks, that it's no longer possible for the government to be up to speed on all the information collecting that's required for national intelligence? In other words, maybe specialization and information collection and analysis has reached the point where you can't expect government agencies to handle all of it, that you have to rely on these specialized companies who've developed their own networks and developed new technology.
I think we have to make a separation between, say, building a computer network, providing information technology systems, that kind of technology that obviously is not going to be produced by the government, that's going to be provided by private sector companies to the government. I think we have to make a differentiation between that and the intelligence analysis, running covert operations, writing reports that get to the president, that get to national security leaders, the people that are paid by us as taxpayers to do that kind of analysis, I think, and within the system of oversight, that should be done by the government. I think clearly, there's lots of technology that the government can't provide that they have to rely on the private sector. I mean, I, as a journalist, I've been, you know, working as a journalist for more than 30 years. I started out, you know, on typewriters, of course, like everybody else. And now I'm working on, on sophisticated computers myself. You know, everyone's gone through that kind of change in the way that they handle information. And of course, the private sector is going to provide the key technologies there. But in terms of like doing the analysis, you know, doing the reports, making the important strategic decisions that have to be made by intelligence officers, that is part of the government. That's what our government, our public sector is for, to serve the people, to serve the interests of the nation, not as a for-profit operation.
Well, Tim Shorrock, thank you very much for talking with us.
I really appreciate being on your show. Thank you.
Tim Shorrock is the author of the new book, Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man?
You probably know that song. It's the opening track from the 1963 album The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan. If you're a Dylan fan, you also know the cover of the album, a photo of a young Dylan and his even younger girlfriend walking arm in arm down a Greenwich Village street. Lots of people have wondered about that woman's story. She tells it now in her new book, A Freewheelin' Time. My guest is Suze Rotolo. She met Dylan when she was 17 and he was 20. They were a couple for about 4 years. She'd moved to Greenwich Village from Queens, New York, on her own after graduating high school. Dylan moved there soon after. At the time, the village was the center of the urban folk scene. Rotolo is an artist and teaches at the Parsons School of Design. She lives in Greenwich Village with her husband. Suze Rotolo, welcome to Fresh Air, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You met Dylan at a marathon folk concert at the Riverside Church in New York in 1961. He wasn't well known yet. He'd only recently arrived in Greenwich Village. You'd already been living there. What attracted you to him then? What did you know of him when you first started seeing him?
Well, there was a folk music club, Gertie's Folk City, in the village, and I used to go there. And he was performing with other people, or he'd play backup harmonica for other groups. And it was kind of the kind of place where musicians played with other people. And then he gradually started playing with this one other folk singer, Mark Spolstra. And so I would see him around, and I enjoyed his harmonica playing. I thought he was really good in a funny kind of way. He'd sit in the back and really get into playing the harmonica. But we didn't actually talk to each other or see each other person to person until that folk concert at Riverside Church, where he was playing and by himself, and he was playing also with Jack Elliott, and that's when we kind of got to know each other.
In Dylan's biographical book, Chronicles, Volume 1, he writes about you in the end of the book, and I want to read some of the things he says about you. He says, "Right from the start, I couldn't take my eyes off her. She was the most erotic thing I'd ever seen. She was fair-skinned and golden-haired, full-blood Italian. The air was suddenly filled with banana leaves. We started talking, and my head started to spin. Cupid's arrow had whistled by my ears before, but this time it hit me in the heart, and the weight of it dragged me overboard. Susie was 17 years old, from the East Coast, had grown up in Queens, raised in a left-wing family. Her father had worked in a factory and had recently died. She was involved in the New York art scene, painted and made drawings for various publications, worked in graphic design and in off-Broadway theatrical productions, also worked on civil rights committees. She could do a lot of things. Meeting her was like stepping into the tales of 1001 Arabian Nights." And then he compares her to a Rodin sculpture come to life and says, "She reminded me of a libertine heroine. She was just my type." What? How does that description sound to you? Do you hear yourself in that description?
I think that's wonderful and generous and a lovely thing that he wrote. And he captured that sense of being young and meeting somebody and being overwhelmed by feelings for them. And that's what young love is. He did that well.
Everyone knows now that Bob Dylan was born Robert Zimmerman and he grew up in Minnesota. What did he tell you about his past when you met him?
Well, at that time when I met him, I think it was the time when we all were people were coming to the village to find or lose themselves, and you live very much in the present. So I don't think any of us really talked about where we came from and what our parents were like. But there were rumors that that was his name because he had to get a cabaret card, and then you had to have documentation. So rumors started flying that it wasn't his real name. I think a lot of people suspected it wasn't his real name, but it didn't make any difference. But for me, once we were a couple and we were together, I was hurt that he didn't tell me. It was okay. He didn't tell everybody else.
But there were other things he told you about his past, that he was abandoned at a young age in New Mexico and went to live with a traveling circus.
Yes, he used to tell those stories. Well, everyone used to tell stories like that, only his were wilder and funnier, and they would contradict each other, and people would wait around to see what the next installment would be that would contradict the other one that he had told a few days before.
So how did you find out that his last name was actually Zimmerman?
We had come home. We were living by then together on West 4th Street, and we had come home one evening, and he was a bit in his cups, and he took his wallet out of his pants, and everything fell on the floor, and I saw his draft card. There were draft cards in those days. And I saw his name, and I was really, that's when I was hurt. I said, "You never told me that this was your real name. I understand you didn't tell anybody else, but you could have at least told me."
No, you said that, you know, just as he didn't want to be too forthcoming about his upbringing and his family, you felt the same way too. But you were from Queens, New York, and mm-hmm. your parents were both communists, and you had
yes.
to grow up with some secrecy because you grew up
exactly.
during the McCarthy era. So
exactly.
you couldn't very well go around talking about your communist parents.
No, I couldn't until 1989. I didn't feel comfortable saying that. So that was why, to give you an idea of how secrecy would make sense in something like that, I could understand people not wanting to talk about their story. And you didn't go around saying that your parents were communists, because what was from the McCarthy era into the 60s certainly left its mark. And I'm sure there were many others with communist parents, certainly in the folk music world, but we didn't even identify each other. You know, it was a secret thing.
Now, you write about how Dylan had to develop and present an image to the outside world. And you write, "Much time was spent in front of the mirror trying on one wrinkled article of clothing after another until it all came together to look as if Bob had just gotten up and thrown something on. Image was all." I found it so amusing to read that, to think that, Dylan was trying on all these clothes, trying to look, authentically like he didn't care.
Yes. Well, it was the image of being a rambling, gambling folk singer, so you couldn't look neatly pressed. After all, also, to give him a little credit, they all did that. You know, they all had to have their costume, how it looked, but it was also, if you think back then, there were folk groups that were very mannered, and like the Kingston Trio, mm-hmm. and impeccably dressed. So these new folk singers were the anti-Kingston Trio image, you know.
While we're talking about image, let's talk about the cover, the now famous cover from the Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, the cover that mm-hmm. you're on with him, walking down a partially snow-covered street. He has his hands in his pockets and his shoulders up because it's cold. And you have your arms wrapped around one of his arms. You're wearing like a green trench coat that's tied around the waist. And you have nearly knee-high boots over your pants.
Mm-hmm.
And you look really in tune with each other. It's such a romantic cover. I mean, what woman didn't want to be on Dylan's arm in that cover? What woman didn't want to be in your place? So tell us how that cover came to be.
It was all very casual, and the apartment was very small, and the photographer came and the publicity guy from Columbia came. So then they figured they'd start taking some pictures in the apartment of Bob, sitting around, pick up your guitar, put it down, sing something. And then Don Hunstein said to me, "Get in some of the pictures." So I did, and he took more pictures. And then he said, "Let's go outside and walk." It was very casual, completely unplanned. And it was freezing outside. And then again, referring to Bob getting dressed, he just took this thin suede jacket that wasn't good for a New York cold winter day. And I had on a couple of sweaters. The last one was his, a big bulky knit sweater, because the apartment was cold. And I threw on a coat on top. So I always look at that picture as I feel like an Italian sausage because I had so many layers on. And he was freezing, and I was freezing and had more clothes on. It was very cold that day.
Well, he was freezing, you say, in part because he wore this light suede jacket because it looked good.
Yes, image.
Even though he knew he was going to be really cold.
Yeah.
And who can blame him? It did look really good.
It looked good. He had impeccable taste.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to sound harsh about this clothes thing, because who wouldn't want to look right on an album cover? It's like
exactly.
Really important. I think who wouldn't want to choose the right article of clothing and risk being cold.
Yes, it's true. Suffer for beauty, isn't it?
How did that album cover change your life?
I had no idea, and I don't think anyone who had anything to do with it thought it would have such an enormous impact. So it became something that was, you know, it was my identifier, but it wasn't my identity. So it became something that was separate from who I knew myself to be, which might sound odd, but I thought it was a great cover, a very unusual cover for the time. And the first time I saw it was he was playing at Carnegie Hall, I think, or Town Hall, and the cover was blown up and put on right outside. It was in black and white and blown up very big. And that really made an impression. It was almost embarrassing. There we were up on 57th Street. Huge, huge. So each time the album began more and more known, as the album became more what it is, it became an iconic album, the more I could detach from it and just look at it, okay, that's what that is. But it was an odd feeling for many years.
I think one of the problems for young women who fall in love with men older, even if they're just slightly older, particularly if that man becomes very famous, is that you risk this kind of mentor-mentee relationship where, you know, the woman is expected to be the learner looking up to the man, and he teaches her everything he knows. And it could really be a kind of uncomfortable relationship, as opposed to like a relationship of equals. But when you and Dylan met, you had so much to learn from each other. You really admired his music and had so much to learn from that. He was really interested in learning about your world. You were working in the civil rights movement. You were working in avant-garde theater. He learned about the music of Weill and Brecht through the fact that you were working on a Brecht production. And he writes in his memoir about how it really changed him to be exposed to that music. You exposed him to art that he was unaware of because you were an artist yourself. I was glad to see that, to see how much you had to learn from each other.
Oh, good, good. That's nice. <'Cause> it's true. We did. We were very curious, and we were both in search of poetry. And we fed each other's curiosity. And I was, well, because I was from New York City also, you know, and he was from Hibbing, Minnesota. So the fact that in New York you're exposed to a lot more, plus the family I came from, we didn't have much money, but we were very culturally, I always think of it as being culturally very, very wealthy because, books we had, we didn't have a TV, but the house was filled with books and phonograph records, and we listened to the radio. I was exposed to all different kinds of music from a very early age. My mother loved Bessie Smith, Billie Holiday, and Edith Piaf, and they listened to opera, classical records we had. It was very, very rich, and when you grow up in that, you just assume everybody else knows all this. But I knew an awful lot about music just from listening and hearing and being exposed to it, whereas with Bob, he heard this music and knew this is what he wanted to investigate, but he had a harder time finding it and finding people. And there are stories now about he would, when he was in Minnesota, stealing people's records so he could learn the music on it. So he had a harder time finding things, whereas I was almost born into it.
you decided to leave for Perugia, Italy. You were supposed to go there after high school. You'd had a trip planned, but because of a car accident, you never made it. And then you moved to Greenwich Village, and then you met Dylan and so on. But the opportunity was offered to you again by your mother. So you decided to leave for Perugia. It was a very difficult decision for you. What was his reaction when you told him you were going?
Well, he didn't want me to go, but at the same time, he didn't want to put pressure on me. But I learned later from a friend that he was furious when she sympathized with my... She said, well, you should go because this is a wonderful opportunity. And then he was very angry with her for a long time. But to me, he was didn't want to come down hard. He did say, don't go, but he didn't want to restrict me from considering going at the same time. And it was a difficult decision for me. I kept hemming and hawing on whether I should or shouldn't or whether I wanted to or not. It was difficult.
Why did you go?
In the end, I think I went for many reasons, and one being because I couldn't stand the arguments anymore that were going on in my own head of should I or shouldn't I? And it did seem like a good thing to do, a real opportunity. And also the village was getting oppressive in many ways.
Greenwich
Village.
Yes,
Greenwich Village was getting oppressive. It was so much the folk music scene, and I wasn't a musician, and I couldn't keep on obsessing about folk music the way the musicians would. So it also seemed like a nice way to get away, and it was only going to be for 3 months maximum, but I ended up staying a good 8 months. Because when I was there, I was no longer in this, I kind of see it as in these small smoky taverns. I was out in the bright sunshine with people from all over the world my age, and I was hearing all this other kind of music and other poets, and I was trying to read Rimbaud in French and trying to, you know, just absorb. It was like a college experience. I hadn't gone to college, and this time that I spent in Perugia in this atmosphere of international students, and I had also found an art academy, a small art academy that I went to. It was just thrilling.
Is the song Boots of Spanish Leather written about your leaving for Italy?
You know, most of the songs that he's written, I hate to say, oh, this is written about me or this, but that's a good example of a song that is a fiction based on an experience he was going through.
And the experience he was going through was the experience of missing you?
Yes. So that's a good example of how it becomes art, your life experience, you translate it into art. It serves a purpose for the music you're making or the art you're making.
So the fiction is that you weren't in Spain, you were in Italy, and did he ever ask for boots of Spanish leather?
No. I think I had a pair, though, of boots of Spanish leather at some point.
Well, here's the song we've been talking about, Boots of Spanish Leather.
Oh, I'm sailing away, my own true love. I'm sailing away in the morning. Is it something I can send you from across the sea? From the place that I'll be landing. No, there's nothing you can send me, my own true love. There's nothing I'm wishing to be owning. Just to carry yourself back to me unspoiled. From across that lonesome ocean.
That's Bob Dylan, and my guest is Suze Rodelow. Her new memoir, A Freewheelin' Time, is about the 4 years she and Dylan were a couple. My guest is Suze Rodelow, the woman walking arm-in-arm with Bob Dylan on the cover of his 1963 album, The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan. Her new memoir is about the 4 years they were a couple. It's called A Freewheelin' Time. When we left off, she was talking about leaving Dylan in Greenwich Village for a trip to Perugia, Italy. After about 8 months in Perugia, you came back to Greenwich Village, and you write that during your absence, he suffered in public. You didn't get a friendly reception when you returned. A lot of people, you say, thought that you'd been cold and indifferent to someone who loved you. And that some people, some of the folk singers deliberately sang songs that Dylan had written about his heartache, as well as any ballad that pointed a finger at a cruel lover when you were around.
Yeah.
And you say it was as if every letter Bob had written to me and every phone call he had made had been performed in a theater in front of an audience. What do you mean by that?
Well, I felt it was very, after all, I've always been a shy person. So to have this relationship kind of thrown right out there in public was very horrible. I thought it was terrible that I was very private. I didn't go broadcasting things around, and yet people seemed to know how I had made him suffer. Publicly, he was letting that out. But I see that that was just his way of working through it, making it a part of his art. But at the time, I just felt so exposed. It was awful.
Well, you moved back to Greenwich Village and you got together, but then you eventually moved out of the apartment mm-hmm. that you shared with Dylan. What was the breaking point for you?
Well, it was all this stuff that was going on around his fame, and there was so much pressure. I just felt that I no longer had a place in this world of this music and fame, and I more and more felt more and more insecure that I was just a string on his guitar, I was just this chick, and I was losing confidence in who I was and the way I felt in Italy, that I was my own self and could continue my life and not become this object that's next to Dylan. And also the more famous he got, there were more pressures on him, and of course there's all these women that were running around, and so it became something that I didn't like being involved anymore. I saw it as a small, cloistered, specialized world that I just didn't belong in it.
Did you feel like you were always competing for his attention with other women who wanted it?
But I didn't want to be in that kind of a situation at all. I didn't feel there was a competition. I just felt there was just he was leaving for another world and another place. And he would expect me to be there always, kind of as a safe haven, so he could come back from wherever he was and whoever he was with. But he'd always have this quiet space in New York. But I couldn't live that way. I wanted my own life in my own way. And even with all this conflict, that tortured young love, you know, it's there. We were still attached to each other, even though we were both going in different directions and needed to go in different directions. And it was harder for me to pull away. It was easier for him to lead several lives. Men could, you know.
This might be too personal, so if it is, you just let me know. Mm-hmm. When Dylan started seeing Joan Baez, and that was such a kind of, there was such public interest in their relationship because they were both famous singers. What was that like for you?
Well, it doesn't have to get personal if we just keep it at this, like to say that, well, he was singing the songs that she needed to sing because she was just singing beautiful ballads with that beautiful voice of hers. And she knew that this wasn't what she could keep on singing and maintain a career. She heard his music and knew this is what she wanted to sing about and what she wanted to sing. And it was natural that they be together because he was writing what she wanted to sing and she was extremely famous. And without her help, I mean, she literally brought him into the folk firmament, bringing him around with her on tour.
So, was that difficult for you to see him with another woman in such a public way?
Well, by then, it was pretty much I was detaching from him. It was difficult because it became so public. People could see, oh, God, there are definitely going to be a couple here, and what are you going to do? And it became very difficult then. And as I said, he was could do go off and be with whoever he wanted to be with and then expect me to be there when he came back to New York. So it was rough for a while.
You're married. You have one child?
Yes.
And your husband's Italian. Did you meet him when you were in Perugia?
Initially, yes. I had met him all that long time ago. But then we met up again many years later. So it's funny that he came from a certain time also. Yeah, and then we met again many years later.
Was he your boyfriend in Perugia?
I knew him then. That's when I first met him.
Do people still recognize you from the Freewheelin' album?
I look exactly the same, Terry.
Yeah. Don't we all?
Yes.
But, you know, still, it doesn't mean you're not recognizable.
Well, for those who notice those things, yes. I mean, otherwise, no. I mean, it's a funny kind of recognition. I mean, it's people who are Dylan files, you know, Dylanophiles, or however I could say that, would know to recognize the name, but not everybody does. So it's kind of a funny, sometimes I'm surprised that someone recognizes me, and, you know, most of the time nobody does. This is going to change that a bit, I suppose.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Good luck with your memoir.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to speak to you.
Suze Rodelow's new memoir is called A Freewheelin' Time, a memoir of Greenwich Village in the 60s. We'll close with another song from the Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, whose album cover is a photo of Dylan and Rodelow. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.